from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. After first pinning the blame on Democrats, President Donald Trump is now singling out far-right House members for the collapse of his health care bill last week.
The president's disappointed in a number of people that he thought were loyal to him that weren't.
That was Chief of Staff Reince Priebus on Fox yesterday. And coming up on Forum, we ask what the stunning defeat means for tax reform and the rest of the Trump administration agenda. We'll also get the latest on the House and Senate Intelligence Committee investigations into Russian interference in the U.S. presidential election. It's all coming up on Forum after this. Welcome to this morning's Forum program. I'm Michael Krasny. The White House announced today that Jared Kushner, President Trump's son-in-law and senior advisor, will testify before the Senate Intelligence Committee as part of its ongoing inquiry into Russian meddling in the 2016 presidential election. At the same time, questions continue to swirl around the House Intelligence Committee's chairman, Devin Nunes, who remains under fire for unilaterally announcing last week that he had evidence that President Obama wiretapped Trump Tower. CNN reports this morning that Nunes was seen on White House grounds the day before that announcement. Meanwhile, fallout continues from House Speaker Paul Ryan's last-minute decision to call off a vote on the GOP bill to replace the Affordable Care Act, as House Republicans now contemplate a bill overhauling the tax code. This hour, we discuss these and other recent political developments with Ron Elving, senior editor and Washington correspondent from NPR, who joins us from Washington, D.C. Good morning, Ron.
Good morning, Michael.
Good to have you aboard again. And Julie Bykowitz is also joining us from Washington, White House reporter for the Associated Press. And good morning, Julie.
Good morning.
Glad to have you both aboard. And let me begin, if I may, Ron, with you. This is, let's start with the health care bill, clearly a defeat for President Trump and also for Paul Ryan. And one wonders who is going to suffer more loss of political capital in this, that is the president or the Speaker of the House.
The president has the advantage of being the president, and there's just really no substitute, you know. It is good to be the king, and he has a myriad of ways of recovering his momentum, either on other issues or by moving on to foreign policy on one issue or another. There is every opportunity for him to be, in his own mind at least, back on top in the days ahead. It's a little more difficult for the Speaker of the House. He has to decide what he thinks he can do to bring his troops back into line. And that is not necessarily going to be easier on issues as divisive as tax reform.
Well, we'll talk about that new issue. At least it certainly has all the earmarks of being a new issue in terms of legislation. But we haven't seen any legislation in going on close to 70 days here. And the fact of the matter is that President Trump certainly has, shall we say, at least from most reports, a lot of infighting going on in the White House.
That's true as well. The White House is a place where everyone is contesting for the president's moments of attention, for the president's, best side. They would like to be the last person to speak to the president before he does something or tweets something or decides something. That's quite a competition. Plus, you have at least three elements here in Steve Bannon, alt-right wing. He's the senior advisor. Reince Priebus, who is close to Paul Ryan. They both come from the same congressional district in Wisconsin, and he is seen as the establishment figure. And then finally, the Trump family, if you will, represented perhaps most by Jared Kushner and his wife, Ivanka Trump.
Well, we're hearing, Julie Bykowitz, that the Freedom Caucus, those who oppose the president on health care, on repeal and replace, are kind of in his lines of fire, or that he's angry at them. We're also hearing that he's angry at the moderates who decided, perhaps because of political reasons, not to side with the president. And he's angry and blaming the Democrats. Who is he more angry at, or who does he see as more culpable for this defeat?
Well, there's plenty of blame to go around, and the president is not shy about pointing fingers. Like you said, he's pointed at the moderates, he's pointed at the conservatives, and also at Democrats. And we are seeing some pretty clear fallout with the Freedom Caucus. They were sort of the subject of one of the president's famous tweets, where he does seem to be paying attention to them and sort of, at this point in time, sort of singling them out as a problem on healthcare specifically. And you got to wonder, you know, is he going to keep his eyes on them with other agenda items going forward? You know, one thing that is just going to be an incredibly complicated factor for both Speaker Ryan and for the president is that even though Republicans really want to tackle tax reform, the very fact that they couldn't get Obamacare, the repeal and replace plan through, makes tax reform more difficult. It now means that it's just going to be that much harder to reform the tax code when you've still got sort of the $1 trillion worth of tax cuts that addressing Obamacare would have provided just becomes incredibly complicated at this point.
And the president did go on record saying from day one he's going to go toward repealing and replacing Obamacare, and it took 7 years of the Republicans saying that that is indeed what they wanted to do above all to come up with a plan that just didn't go over and was seen by many as really a kind of tax cut for the rich. Are they going to move into similar territory with tax reform? It almost seems, unless he can work with Democrats in some ways, foretold.
Well, the problem is that it's not clear who his best partners are at this point. And I think that the White House this week is spending a good bit of time sort of analyzing where to go from here and who, you know, who best to sort of cut deals with at this point. You know, by all accounts, the White House was taken aback by not being able to get the repeal and replace plan at least through the House. And so they're just really casting about for allies at this point before they, you know, attempt their next big thing, which looks to be tax reform.
The president, though, has also been saying that Obamacare will explode, which seems to me, just as a layperson, maybe opens him up for a lot of possibilities of lawsuits, because if it does explode and people lose that health care, they've got something to litigate.
Well, who knows? I think that some Republicans do see sort of the unraveling of Obamacare through natural forces as a potential political win for them, but that may in fact turn out to be a miscalculation because, you know, there's really no getting around it. Republicans control the House, the Senate, and the White House, and so if Obamacare, you know, unravels in such a way that it affects, you know, millions and millions of voters, it's hard for them, I think, to make the case that, hey, there was nothing that they could do. This is all, you know, the Democrats' fault. It's a Democratic plan. But that does seem to be sort of one of the political sort of mindsets that's pervasive in the White House at this point.
Again, Julie Bykowitz with us from Washington is White House reporter for the Associated Press, and Ron Elving, also with us from Washington, is senior editor and correspondent on the Washington desk with NPR News. Ron, take us through what's going on vis-a-vis the Intelligence Committee. I mean, with Devin Nunes now supposedly on White House grounds before he originally was thought to be on White House grounds, we have a whole different picture, don't we?
Yes, we do, and it's a murky one. It's really quite a mystery what exactly Devin Nunes is up to at this point or what he was up to last week. If we just walk through this a little bit, I think most of us remember that a week ago today there were hearings in Nunes's committee in the House Intelligence Committee, and they were grilling James Comey, who is the FBI director, and Mike Rogers from the National Security Administration, or agency rather, and these guys were telling them there is a limit on what we can tell you, but we do know this much. That we know of no evidence that President Obama ordered any kind of surveillance of Donald Trump, as the president, current president, had tweeted. And number two, we do have an investigation going in the FBI, started last July, into the relationship between the Trump campaign and the Russian effort to interfere in the American election. Now, we're not saying that anything happened on Election Day of a skullduggery nature or that somehow the vote itself was knocked askew by the Russian hacking. We're saying, or that rather the FBI is saying, they see enough there to investigate in whether or not there was Russian interference in terms of hacking the DNC and others on the Democratic side, passing that information through an intermediary to WikiLeaks, getting it out into the public eye, and in all of that having a great deal of benefit for the Trump campaign. Was there any sort of involvement of the Trump campaign, in that effort on the part of the Russians? And we heard a little bit about that a week ago. Then Devin Nunes, on Tuesday apparently, went to the White House grounds, as he says. Apparently, some people are speculating that probably means to the Eisenhower Executive Office Building, which is adjacent to the White House, but not in the White House. Nunes said he was not in the White House. And there is a secure room there in the Eisenhower where people sometimes view classified information. So that is possibly what he is referring to. But he does seem to have disappeared for a period of time, left his staff members behind, went somewhere. Now we're hearing that it was on the grounds of the White House. And then on Wednesday, he has this kind of impromptu news conference to talk about there being some evidence that maybe some part of the Trump team was surveilled after the election, and maybe that was improper, and that he had gotten this information somewhere around from the White House, apparently, we now think, and he wasn't saying on Wednesday. He didn't tell the Democrats on his committee what that was all about, and then he went off to have a meeting with Trump. So all of that has raised a lot of questions about just what Devin Nunes is up to. Meanwhile, the Senate Intelligence Committee is starting to get underway and has a lot of questions for Chairman Nunes.
And Julie Bygewitz, Adam Schiff on the Democratic side of this bipartisan committee essentially has said that Devin Nunes tried to give Donald Trump, the president, cover and that the committee is fatally compromised. Does that mean we're going to have what John McCain and others would like to see happen, some kind of independent committee?
You know, there does seem to be a growing drumbeat for that sort of an approach. Whether it actually happens is a little bit mysterious at this point. Speaker Ryan, I believe, just said that he still has confidence in the Intel Committee's ability to do its job in a fair and impartial manner. But all this news today about Devin Nunes and where he was and, you know, continued speculation of who he was meeting with does sort of add to that perception that perhaps it's best investigated by an independent body. We'll just have to see what happens with that. The Nunes information is still sort of developing and breaking throughout the day. You know, it's worth pointing out, he is saying that he was at the White House grounds to be around a secure location, but there's certainly no reason he couldn't have met his source, whoever that may be, on the Hill, where there's also, you know, rooms that have you know, security sort of measures. So lots of mystery about what he was doing, and we'll have to see what more we can learn today about that.
But a mystery, Ron Elving, which suggests in many people's minds the real possibility that the White House may have been the source for these documents for Nunes.
It does seem odd that he would go to the White House grounds to meet with a source if the source, for example, did not have access to the White House grounds himself or herself. And so that raises questions. And as Julie suggests, he could have done it on the Hill if the source were someone who could get to the Hill without being recognized by everyone who might see him or her. And so the speculation is that someone who would be a recognizable representative of the White House or of Donald Trump was meeting Devin Nunes in some building, somewhere on the White House grounds, possibly the Eisenhower Executive Office Building, where there is that classified area where people can view things, see things, hear things in a secure environment. And that then, as a result of that information sharing, then Nunes felt that the next day he had something to tell Donald Trump. Now, why the bouncing ball? Why all those different bank shots? I think we can see an advantage, perhaps, for somebody in the White House who wanted to get that information out there to do it through Nunes and then have Nunes come back to the White House and act as though he were bringing the news to them.
But Nunes is still on record, is he not, as saying, Ron, that he doesn't believe President Trump, there's nothing, certainly from the testimony given by the NSA and the FBI, to indicate that President Trump's statements and his tweets are true about President Obama bugging the Trump Tower?
That is correct. If you parse it very carefully, he is referring to the testimony given by those two individuals at his hearing a week ago, and he is also referring to an allegation, if we were to take Trump's tweet of a couple of weeks ago quite literally, that Barack Obama personally ordered a wiretap of the Trump Tower. That may be a very loose treatment of what Nunes and some other people are alleging happened, which is that someone on the Trump team was caught up inadvertently perhaps or accidentally, in a broader surveillance of someone, perhaps Russian, perhaps some other personage, and that their name came up in the investigation because they happened to be on a phone at some point, or perhaps not a phone, but another form of communication, internet communication, that somehow got them into this net that was being cast by the FBI or the NSA or some other element of the federal intelligence establishment that was investigating all of the above, investigating this whole issue of interference in the election campaign.
Again, Ron Elving with us from Washington, senior editor and correspondent on the Washington desk for NPR News, and Julie Bykowitz, White House reporter for the Associated Press. Julie, I'd like to go to you about the fact that Paul Manafort has agreed, the former Trump campaign manager, to testify before the House committee. And I don't know if it's clear yet whether that's going to be public or behind closed doors, but so has Jared Kushner. And where is this going to take us, do you think, or what is likely to happen, particularly in light of the fact that there has been, as we've said, a lot of action on the Hill to try to indeed move toward an independent commission?
Sure. Well, I think with such a confusing series of investigations and, you know, real murkiness around the ties and who knows what and who's investigating what, I think it's a good sign that people like Paul Manafort and now Jared Kushner are agreeing to go talk with people on the Hill about Russia and about, you know, specific conversations that they had with the Russian ambassador to the U.S. Any amount of clarity that anyone who's involved in this situation can bring, I think, can only be a good thing. And hopefully we will see some of that in public settings. I think that that is a little bit unknown at this point. But the fact that people are starting to cooperate a little bit more transparently bodes well for maybe eventually untangling this whole mess. And, you know, I really sort of feel for people trying to follow it along because it's a rapidly changing and very confusing situation. Let's just hope that those testimonies become public.
We're talking, if you've just joined us, about recent political news, and we do invite you to join this conversation. In fact, let me do that now. Extend the invitation and tell you that you can join us, obviously, by phone, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. Let me give you the number to call if you want to voice your own thoughts or if you have questions or comments for our two guests. The number to call is 866-733-6786, and you can reach us now at that number, again, toll-free, wherever you're listening to us, 866 or however, 733-6786. You can also post on our website any questions or comments you might have, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. Or join us by going to our Facebook page or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is at KQED Forum, or you can email us, and our email address is simply forum@kqed.org. I'd like to go back to you, Ron Elving, since you've written about the Gorsuch nomination, and sort of get your thoughts in light of all this political changing fluid things that are going on moment to moment here, what's likely to happen. You think, I mean, essentially it seems to boil down in many people's minds to, will the Democrats try to filibuster or will they sort of work things toward being tactical and thinking about the next nomination that's pretty inevitable given the age of some of the justices? What do you think?
There is every possibility that the Democrats will have offered something with respect to letting Gorsuch go through without much of a struggle beyond what we've already had in the committee hearings, and then save their powder, if you will, for a perhaps more controversial situation down the road if a more Democratic-appointed or Democratic-leaning justice should retire. That would be logical, but there are a couple of complicating factors. The first one is the ghost of Merrick Garland, who was President Obama's appointment to this same vacancy. A year ago, he was never given a hearing. He was never given any dignity at all by the Republican majority in the Senate, and the Democrats are highly resentful of that and don't feel that there should even be a vacancy at this point in history, that it should have been filled by Merrick Garland last year, and that it was highly improper for the Republicans to resist that nomination, which was made constitutionally and legally a year ago by Barack Obama. So the Democrats have that hangover. Then the other thing is that they feel Donald Trump is weakened at this moment. His approval ratings are quite low for a president in his first few months, and he has just had this health care debacle. So as a result of all those things, the Democrats sense an opportunity to press their case in the Senate against a justice or a potential justice whom they think would be quite a conservative one, perhaps as much as Clarence Thomas, perhaps more than, say, Chief Justice John Roberts or Justice Alito, that this is somebody they're afraid to have on the court for 30 or 40 years, so they're going to try to make their case on the floor.
And a big question looming, Julie Bykowitz, is will the Democrats essentially become the party of no, as the Republicans were during the Obama administration? Not only Gorsuch, but we're talking about legislation in general.
Well, sure. I mean, that seems to be, you know, where they're at this point, and there's a really sort of clear case for explaining why that is. And I think Speaker Ryan laid it out best when he was talking about his disappointment on health care reform falling through. You know, he said it's harder to govern than it is to just be an opposition party. And now Democrats find themselves in the position of being that opposition party. They're benefiting from a very enthused and engaged sort of progressive base out there who are showing up at town hall meetings, who are making calls on the Hill, and who just really have been donating money to different candidates and causes. And so there's really no sort of incentive at this point for Democrats to be anything other than the party of no. Now, that certainly could change, and I think with the Gorsuch nomination, you do see a little bit of sort of the middle of America sort of scratching their heads and saying, you know, this guy has great accolades. It doesn't really make sense for the Democrats to be standing in the way. But more broadly speaking, on a number of different issues, Democrats really sort of are in this position where there's no sort of political reason for them to be cooperating with the president and with the majority party at this point.
Well, one also has to ask at this point, and I'm going to ask you, Ron Elving, with all of this fractionalism in the Republican Party and with all the division and, frankly, toxic partisan polarities, can we count on the possibility of not avoiding a government shutdown at the end of April?
There will be some kind of struggle over the question of raising the debt ceiling. This is always a difficulty for the majority party in Congress because nobody wants to vote for more debt, even though no one wants to cut the budget and prevent more debt, and no one wants to raise taxes to prevent more debt. So everyone incurs more debt and then hates to admit it by raising the debt ceiling. And that's quite a bipartisan reality. So we will hear more about it. In the end, the Republicans are going to have to come up with some way to sell themselves on a highly unpleasant, toxic, even kind of a choice. And they're going to have to sell themselves on why they do it, because if you don't raise the debt ceiling, then the United States begins to default on some of its obligations. That is to say, we ruin our credit rating. And we are the most credit-worthy government in the world, which helps us enormously in many, many ways. So that's really a non-starter as a policy suggestion. They're going to have to find a way to sell themselves on doing it.
And we're coming up on a break. We will go to your calls and emails when we return. Again, we invite you to join us at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786, or email us your thoughts, your questions, or comments, forum@kqed.org, or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. We started off talking about health care. We're doing kind of a political roundup here. I wanted to mention that some of you may be aware of the fact that Senator Bernie Sanders has decided to put a bill through for full coverage and single payer, estimated $1.4 trillion and estimated not to get through, obviously, a Republican legislature. But again, we do invite your involvement in the program. Please join us. We're talking to Ron Elving and we're talking to Julie Bykowitz, both of them in the nation's capital. Ron Elving with NPR News, Julie Bykowitz with the Associated Press. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. In this hour, we're doing analysis of all the latest political news, hearing reactions to the last-minute decision to pull the vote on the Republican health care bill, and discussing the state of the House Intelligence Committee's probe into Russian interference in the 2016 election. Julie Bykowitz with us from Washington as White House reporter for the Associated Press, and Ron Elving also with us from Washington as senior editor and correspondent on the Washington desk with NPR News. And let's go right to your calls. Mark, let's begin with you. Mark, you're on.
Good morning. Great program, as always. I have a question and a comment, and I will take my answer off the air. My question is, now that Paul Manafort is going to be testifying before the House Intelligence Committee, possibly with Roger Stone, I'd like to know if they will be testifying under oath, because if they're not, there's no point to it. And my comment is that I believe that Devin Nunes needs to be investigated by the FBI as well. He has an inherent conflict of interest being the head of the Intelligence Committee and leading this investigation. At the same time, he was on Donald Trump's transition team, and as far as I'm concerned, I just think he's a treasonous disgrace. Thank you.
All right, thank you for the call. Let me go right to Ron Elving on the first point, Ron, if you would.
This is a big question mark. We don't know exactly the circumstances of either Paul Manafort's testimony or Roger Stone's. There is clearly an advantage for them in not coming under subpoena. It's clearly a better atmosphere if they come in as volunteers. We also know that Jared Kushner has said he would be glad to talk to the Senate Intelligence Committee.
And, but under oath or not under oath, we don't know at this
point. Let's all just come talk to the committee, and I don't believe that we have determined, or I don't believe it has been decided, whether they would be testifying under oath. But on the other hand, even if they're not under subpoena, why not have them testify under oath? There is a certain, I'm sure their attorneys would object and say, there's no accusation here, there's no crime alleged by any of these people. If this is just a friendly hearing in which we're trying to gather information, why should we ask them to be sworn? And of course, the reason is because then if they don't tell the truth, there's a perjury charge and lying to Congress is a crime. But
unless you're Jeff Sessions.
I mean, on the other hand, what about Jeff Sessions? I think there the question is not so much was he under oath, but the question is whether or not he could define the misleading that he did, the inaccurate testimony he gave about his own contacts with the Russian ambassador. One could define that as not a lie in his mind, because in his mind he didn't think that it was covered by the question. He didn't think they were talking about a subject that was relevant to the discussion, which is a little bit of a strain to credulity. But he could maintain that and say that wasn't perjury.
And the likelihood of the FBI investigating Devin Nunes?
I don't think it's high at this particular time. I know Elijah Cummings, who is the ranking Democratic member on the House Oversight Committee, has already called for that. There will be others who would say it's appropriate. But here again, Nunes has not yet done anything that would be seen as necessarily criminal or demanding an investigation, unless you want to say that he shouldn't be leading the House investigation into all these allegations when he seems to be in some sense or another playing a special sort of backdoor game with the people being investigated.
And here's Peter. Peter, join us. You're on the air.
Hello. I have a question regarding FBI's role in this, because I wonder if they are investigating this or if they have a part in the role here, because I'm thinking, why did they not release information about their investigation on Trump while they did on Hillary before the election?
Yeah, the question has come up before. Julie Breakwitz, can you shed some light on that?
Well, that's a major question that certainly Democrats are particularly interested in. And, you know, are we ever going to sort of understand a little bit more about why decisions were made for the FBI to get a little bit more out in front on what it was doing with regard to Clinton's campaign and Hillary Clinton than they certainly did with Trump and his campaign? I think that's an open question. Comey's been up to the Hill, was planning to go up again this week, but I don't know that that is still on. But there's certainly a lot more information that we can learn about the FBI and some of the choices that it made in disclosing and, you know, making more widely known certain investigations versus others.
Let me thank the caller and read some comments that are coming in here. Frank writes, "A central problem for the Republicans is the incompetence of the president. He clearly has an inability to understand complex issues and navigate the political process. The president, like Nunes, is in way over his head." It's becoming a fairly strong perception in many people's minds. Julie Bykowitz, want to comment?
Well, I think kind of overarching this, both the healthcare issue and in some ways the Russia investigation, is the fact that the Republican-led Congress is not at a point yet, and maybe this will change, where they want to sort of seriously drill down on what the Trump campaign did during the election, and really sort of holding the president to account the way that they would if a Democrat were in office. And, you know, certainly you could make the argument that Democrats would be treating one of their own the same way as well. But that's a behavior that we're seeing from Congress that certainly could change if the president sort of runs off the rails on certain issues and angers a good bit of Congress, particularly the Speaker of the House. I think you'd have a completely different approach on a lot of these issues, whether it's ethics and sort of conflicts of interest in the White House, whether it's Russia and that investigation, if the Hill felt that they wanted to take a more serious look at some of the things that the Trump campaign and Trump presidency have done.
Let me go to some more listener questions. And Ron Elving, for you, Wendy wants to know, is the Garland appointment still viable? If he didn't withdraw, and if President Obama didn't withdraw the nomination, is it still open? I see no provision in the Constitution stating that the nomination dies with the end of a president's term in office.
More or less everything dies at the end, not of the president's term in office, but at the end of a Congress. That nomination was submitted to Congress, like I said earlier, a year ago, and that Congress actually came to an end the first week of January of this year. So everything that was a live issue, everything that was a bill, everything that was pending business, including the nomination of Merrick Garland, died the first week of January when that Congress wrapped and the new Congress was sworn in, the one that's sitting now.
Another question, Ron, for you on health care and tax cuts. Ben says, now that health care spending will continue, where do the Republicans plan to cut spending in order to make their tax cut plans a reality?
This is a big, big, big problem for the Republicans because they were counting not only on cutting some spending, they were also counting on some revenue changes that were going to help them grease a tax reform proposal that they have promised, committed to, making revenue neutral. That's Washington speak for it's not going to raise the amount of money the federal government takes in, and it's not going to contribute to the deficit. So we're not going to be taking more of the taxpayers' money, and we're also not going to be borrowing more money as a consequence of tax reform. That's the commitment. That's what they did back in 1986 when last the two parties were able to get together in Ronald Reagan's presidency and actually reform the tax code in a major way, and one that I would say showed that actually good, sensible policy could be made by the two parties in concert. It was one of the best bills that I've seen in 32 years of being in Washington, and one of the best things accomplished. Of course, it got undone systematically over the last several decades, as happens to tax reforms. We had it in the 20s. We had tax reform again 30 years later in the 50s. And then we had the 1986 bill. And lo and behold, here we are 30-some years later trying to do it again. Maybe they can find it within their hearts and souls to do it again. But right now, we're not moving in a good direction because the parties aren't working together. And even within the Republican Party, the ruling party, they are not working together.
And here's Philip, our next caller. Philip, you're on the air. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you for this program. You know, during the first year and a half of Bill Clinton's administration, there were big problems. And it wasn't until July of 1994 when he hired Leon Panetta to take over the White House that things began rolling in his favor. In fact, David Durkin came out with some complaints recently about how bad the Trump for 6-8 weeks it is, whatever it is, and yet he was part of the original Clinton team. So I'm wondering if more time we need to give the Trump administration time to get their act together. I'm wondering what your guests have to say about that.
Yeah, let me go to you on this, Julie Bykowitz. Some are saying there's too much impatience and too much expectation with the Trump administration. Your thoughts?
Well, I think the White House, and specifically the president, has to be keeping that in mind as well. You know, is it time for him to make a change with regard to some of his senior leadership? It certainly, you know, we're not 100 days into it, so it certainly feels early. But on the other hand, you know, sometimes a shakeup helps you sort of more clearly identify a course ahead. Pretty much since day one and even before day one, there have been reports by every news organization in town about sort of feuding factions within the White House and who's up and who's down and different people who are close to the president with different approaches to things. And there hasn't really been sort of a dominant personality, someone that we can point to and say, this person is really setting the course for the White House. Now, whether that changes with, having health care end in such a debacle, maybe that inspires the president to make a major change on, who he's listening to and who's sort of leading the charge from a chief of staff sort of perspective, but that's still there hasn't been any concrete movement along those lines. I think you mentioned at the top of the program that Jared Kushner will be taking on sort of a SWAT team of assessing the government, but a lot of us read that story and felt, well, Kushner has been doing a lot of this all along, and maybe this is sort of a rebranding, an effort to change the subject. It's unclear if that new sort of spin on what he's doing translates into him actually having a more powerful sort of presence in the White House.
Well, some are speculating just the opposite, that he's been moved into that, it's called the White House Office of American Innovation. It's trying to set up kind of a business SWAT team, that he was moved into that position because Bannon wanted more power and got more power. And President Trump was supposedly mad at his son-in-law for being away a weekend skiing that all the healthcare stuff was going on.
Well, that's a possibility. I mean, our reporting has shown that Bannon was one of the voices that was sort of urging the president to not sort of fully go forward with this initial health care plan and not get, not brand it Trump care or really sort of take it on as a policy of his own and to keep somewhat of a safe distance. Now, others in the White House were advising him exactly the opposite. And just based on the fact that the bill went down, that would certainly sort of indicate that Bannon was right on that front. And perhaps that's translated to him regaining a little bit of stature at the White House.
And a question from Malcolm, Ron Elving, about Steve Bannon. Malcolm says, how does Bannon's appointment to the National Security Council bear on this entire inquiry?
The entire inquiry turns on whether or not you believe the leaks from the part of the White House that are anti-Bannon or the leaks from the part of the White House that is pro-Bannon. His role in the National Security Council is not germane, perhaps, to the health care bill in particular, but it does speak to a degree of trust that Donald Trump has had in him up to now. It speaks to the degree to which Steve Bannon has been able to insist on certain kinds of power, such as sitting on the NSC, and get it. We have seen a lot of success from Steve Bannon with reference to the infighting in the White House. We have not seen so much success for some of the things that Steve Bannon has been in favor of doing. For example, the travel ban, the initial version of it, which he seems to have argued for bringing out as a flashbang, shock and awe. Don't tell people we're going to do this. Just do it. Catch the bad guys in mid-bad guy. And that didn't work out so well because, obviously, the people who had to administer it didn't know what to do. And then the federal courts, of course, took a very dim view of it. So that was not a success. That was not a winner. Steve Bannon was apparently tasked with winning over the House Freedom Caucus in a big meeting with some of their members last week. And he sat down and told them, look, this really isn't something we can argue about. You've just got to vote for the bill. I don't particularly care for the bill either, but we all have to be for it because that's where we're going and that's how we're going to get it out of the House. And then we'll fix it in the Senate, or we won't, but we will fix it eventually with other legislation and administrative action when one thing we can't do is just fail in the House. Well, the House Freedom Caucus said, you can't talk to us like that, and they went and voted against it anyway. So at this point, Bannon doesn't seem to be racking up a lot of wins, but he does still seem to have the president's ear, and he still seems to have all those positions of power the president has given him.
Yeah, one of those reports I read, Bannon said, essentially, I order you to vote in favor of this. And someone said the last time, one of the Freedom Caucus members said, last time I was ordered to do something, it was my father when I was 18, and I didn't do it anyway. I'm also interested in pursuing this a little bit with you, Ron, because there was some talk about Bannon wanting the votes to be public and wanting to compile essentially a list of those who opposed, sort of an enemies list, or what?
Well, if not an enemies list, at least a disloyal Republicans list, because without a vote on Thursday night, as we expected, or Friday afternoon, as they promised, without a vote, we don't know exactly how anyone would have voted. Now, we have a lot of people telling us how they would have voted, yes or no. But apart from the Democrats, who seem to be pretty solidly no's, there's always that question mark about some of the Republicans. Some of them might be saying they were going to vote one way or the other, but we'll never know because it did not get to the floor. In the end, the leadership decided they were better off not knowing what the final count was, because the final count, had it been known, would have been devastating. On the other hand, we will never know exactly whom to visit retribution on, and that might be okay with Paul Ryan, too. He doesn't really want the White House to have a list of people that they're going after, because Paul Ryan would rather run the House himself.
Julie Bykowitz, a tweet from Martin, who asks, if Manafort never had a security clearance, how can a closed hearing be justified?
Well, that's a good question. We just don't know enough yet as to how his sort of cooperation and his decision to talk with lawmakers will play out. I don't know if there's some negotiation, since there are a number of people who have now agreed to come in, like you mentioned, Manafort and then Jared Kushner and Carter Page, who was an advisor to the Trump campaign at one point, and certainly Roger Stone as well, a longtime advisor to Trump. All of those gentlemen have agreed to come in and talk. And so, you know, at this point, are they all sort of discussing ways to approach it, you know, from one sort of set of rules, or will the rules be varied? It's all a little bit up in the air at this point. And again, really important point here, since they're all coming in voluntarily, there's not as much leverage at this point that Congress has. It's not, again, it's not like they're coming on under subpoena, where Congress would be able to sort of set its standards a little differently than just under this voluntary agreement.
Let me go to more calls, and let's bring on Wynn next. Wynn, you're on.
Thanks. I'm old enough to remember the days when a prominent Democrat like Tip O'Neill, Speaker of the House, and a prominent Republican like Ronald Reagan could get together, talk about major issues, and come up with some compromise legislation. I even remember when three Democrats and three Republicans got together and formed the immigration program that was going to solve our problem until it got ground up in the politics. Now all the senators and congressmen just spend all their time raising money. When, with all the vitriol in the Washington scene, is there any possibility that we could possibly get together to those days when we could cross the aisle and put together things that were good for the country?
Yeah, Wynn, you make me think of Chris Matthews' book, Tip and the Gipper, where he talked about all those crossing the aisles. Ron Elving, things aren't too prosperous looking on that score, are they?
No, we don't have that kind of relationship between a Democratic leader on the Hill and the president. We don't have a relationship on that order between a Democratic leader on the Hill and a Republican leader on the Hill. And that's what it takes. You need some personal relations. You need some people who can talk to each other and have at least some trust that their negotiations will be in good faith and will have a common goal of coming up with some sort of solution to a problem. We don't have that now. I'm not going to try to date exactly when it went away, but the caller is essentially describing the situation in the 1980s. It has not been like that for quite a long time. Certainly, the impeachment period in the House in the late 90s was debilitating. There have been many moves made by both parties since that have also undercut trust. And, of course, the members don't live here anymore. They used to come to Washington, live here, and develop relationships with each other. Their families oftentimes got to know each other. There was more of a barbecue on Friday night mentality. And now, of course, all the members, virtually all the members, go home virtually every weekend. That has come to be expected by the voters. With modern transportation, everybody expects their members to come home and go to pancake breakfast at home back in the district. Even senators do that now as a rule. And so there's much less of the personal relationship. And the politics of the country also have changed. We're a more polarized country than we were 35 years ago.
Well, apropos of what we're talking about here is a tweet, Ron, from a listener who's essentially asking if the Democrats can help fix Obamacare. He says, I'd like to see the Democrats come back with a bill to fix Obamacare and bring along a few sane Republicans, but we need new Democratic leaders to do this.
Well, yes, and you also would need a new attitude within the Democratic base because, as has already been observed, I mean, this is an energized progressive or Democratic or left-leaning base of voters who are extremely angry about the Trump election and feel that they have an opportunity to truly resist. And you've heard this word resist with a capital R being used widely. That's not usually part of the American political argot. This is more like the Tea Party resistance to Barack Obama 8 years ago this spring. It's angry, it's spontaneous, and it's a little bit out of control with respect to the leadership of the party itself. They can't control it, and maybe they shouldn't be able to control it, but the point is they don't really know how to respond to it except by saying, we can't cooperate with this president, much as the Republicans did in the spring of 2009 in deciding to break off negotiations with the Obama administration about health care and about a lot of other things. And now we're seeing the flip side of that 8 years later.
Again, Ron Elving with us from Washington is senior editor and correspondent on the Washington desk for NPR News. Julie Bykowitz is White House reporter for the Associated Press, and she examines conflicts, ethics, and influence at the White House and Congress. And Deborah writes, Julie, as long as the Trump campaign is under FBI investigation, is it reasonable to hold up the Gorsuch confirmation? That's a question that Chuck Schumer himself asked, isn't it?
Well, I think that I'm just reading some headlines here that there's a new sort of next date, early April, so I guess that's already next week, for the next move on Gorsuch. Democrats have really sort of delayed this in some ways as much as they can, and we're getting to the end of what they're able to do just through their own sort of sheer numbers. And I don't think that there's much more that they can do sort of tying into the larger investigation that's going on at this point. You know, I hesitate to say that because every day there's sort of a different storyline that emerges on Russia, so you never know what's around the corner. But at this point, again, it's sort of Democrats have really sort of played out all of the cards that they had, and there's just, you know, they're the minority party, and they've done what they can to delay. There's not much more that they can do at this point.
Well, I'm also looking at a tweet here, and let me go to you on this, Julie, from a listener. It says, Republicans are a mess because they don't hear the people. Democrats don't align with them unless the agenda speaks to us, the people. Where are we now in terms of this two-party system? I mean, the Democratic National Committee isn't doing so great either on most scores. Julie?
Well, you know, I covered money in politics before taking on this new role, and that's always, for the past, you know, couple of years, particularly since Citizens United became sort of the law of the land. It's always been sort of interesting to watch how the parties themselves, the Republican National Committee and the Democratic National Committee, have really sort of lost their power in some ways in politics, both on policy debates and in picking candidates and backing candidates, because there are so many other forces at play, so many outside groups that are not perfectly aligned with the RNC or the DNC on some issues. So you've really seen a deterioration in the power of the actual party, whether it's the Democrats or Republicans, for a number of years. And that's, you know, that's very much highlighted after, you know, after Bernie Sanders' insurgency in the Democratic race, and of course President Trump on the Republican side certainly didn't initially have the full backing of traditional Republicans and the RNC itself. So it will be very interesting to see how that plays out in the future. You've got really two completely different forces that are both outside the party that are increasingly playing a role in politics. You've got the big money on one side, and then the small money also kind of weighing in and saying, hey, we don't want to just sort of accept, you know, what the party is telling us our next elected officials should be. So it really will make for an interesting midterm election to see where those forces sort of move the different candidates in the upcoming election.
You mentioned Senator Sanders. I didn't mean to give him short shrift before, but his bill about full coverage and single payer, I mean, it's not likely to go anywhere, was my reading of it. Any other thoughts on it, Julie?
Well, I think you're right. It's not likely to go anywhere, but it serves as a reminder to the people who have supported him that this is, you know, he's still out there sort of fighting the fight. And what that does is it inspires his many supporters to maybe chip in a little bit more money. And what he does with that money is going to be very interesting. He's still got this massive group of massive email list that he assembled from his campaign. He's converted that into a nonprofit, and that nonprofit could be a big player when it comes to the Democratic primaries in the midterms.
Ron Elving, I want to go back to you for a moment here because Daniel, one of our listeners, writes, and as we've been saying, things continue to erupt almost daily. Jared Kushner's newly disclosed meeting with Russian banker Sergei Gorkov in December, the latest surprise, he says. Your thoughts?
There will probably be many surprises if you are surprised to learn that Jared Kushner has been talking to business people from all over the world. He has Asian investors in some of his own properties that he manages with his family, with his father. And
they're negotiating with China probably as we speak, aren't they?
As we speak. And this all has to do with the larger Trump operation writ large. And they have not found it in their hearts, and they have not found it in the law in their own minds, that they should have to divest themselves from any of this, or that they should step too far away from running their own businesses while they run the business of the government. So that's going to be a very constant story for the next 4 years at least. And so we look at Jared Kushner and we think, wow, he doesn't have an elected position. He doesn't even have an appointed position. And yet, apparently, he's going to have a great deal of power while he continues to do business deals all over the world. And were those Russians that he was talking to in December strictly interested in a business proposition, or did they also have some kind of connection to Vladimir Putin and to the power structure of Russia? We've seen over the weekend that that power structure in Russia is not necessarily as popular as some of the polls Vladimir Putin puts out about himself would indicate. So perhaps there's more turmoil there, and perhaps they're looking to their connections to the Trump world to see what is in it for them and what they might be able to leverage, either in a money sort of sense or in a political power sort of sense, through that relationship.
We're going to be hearing the word emoluments more often, I think, as the 4 years continue. Quick question, Julie, for you. We've got seconds left here, but James writes, I worked in a secure room at the White House during the Carter administration. There are several such rooms, both within the West Wing and in the Eisenhower Executive Office Building. There are also many such rooms in the U.S. Capitol and many other locations in the vicinity. Basically, they have lead-lined walls and signal scrambling envelopes. There was no reason for Devin Nunes to seek a secure location in the White House to view classified intelligence. Julie?
Yeah, I mean, that's the bottom line. It's, we need to know a lot more about why he chose that location, and does that location sort of indicate the type of person he was talking to?
That will be the last word. Thank you, Julie Bykowitz. Thank you, Ron Elving. Another hour of Forum up ahead. Stay tuned for it. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.